next part is caching. Yeah, caching. What do we all say? Caching or caching? Cache. I don't know. Everyone but Australians says, or maybe New Zealanders, say cache. So I say cache normally, but I'm now, you know, voiced with the whole cache thing, because when you're talking to people online or whatever, they go, cache, what the hell's that? You're like, well, it's like a cache, I guess. Ben, what do you call it?
Cache.
See, it's a cache, told you. But yeah, we're big on the cache. So a couple of the problems you have with views, and this is endemic across any sort of system when you go about caching something, is that if you change the underlying model, that cache somehow needs to be refreshed, and that can be quite tricky. So maybe we want to just create a page with a news rule on it, stick some news items on it.
Is going to maybe just do this label.
Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah, do that. That's fine. So one of the problems that we generally face is that you have... Well, let's show how caching works in Far Cry, and we'll talk about the problems and how we address them afterwards. Okay, so every view actually has a whole series of decorators that we can use to change the behavior of that view. They're all implemented using just a simple comment system. So you put @, and then the specific parameter that you want to have applied to that view. There are options for globally applying these sort of things across the framework and so on, but I think for caching, global caching options are just a bad idea all around. You want to be quite specific about how things are being cached. So Matt's just turning on some output so we can actually see whether things are being cached, not behind the scenes. And let's have a look at a typical page execution without anything going on. The nice thing that we have, one of the things I've added in the framework is CF timers around every view call. So if you turn on timers, you can see down the bottom how fast it's taking each view in your kind of composite view to actually execute. You can try and locate and isolate views that are taking longer than other views, obviously, to work. You can independently cache each individual unique view that's resting here. There's a display page standard which renders the entire page. It's obviously the one taking the longest, and each of these are fragments, if you like, of that page that are being jigsaw pieced together, the header, the footer, the body, and so on. So if we were to cache some of these, which one do you want to do?
So I'm going to cache the display type body.
Yep.
So if we refresh this, there's no caching, it just keeps going. It's around 7 milliseconds.
So if you make any changes to the decorators on views, you need to reinitialize the application, because all of that, when you initialize the application for the first time, is stored specifically across the entire application. So it knows exactly the behavior of these particular views.
So now we can see we've lost the call to each of these display labels, because display type body, which if we go back into the code, is this guy here, which I've cached. It's now cached, so it doesn't have to run all this code again. It's just...
this running at the once. So far, so good.
So far, so good.
That's even faster.
Sorry, what?
Well, you just replace it with the next, it's even
faster. Yeah. One of my tricks, you know.
So you can nominate another decorator which specifies exactly how long that cache will last. By default, it's 24 hours, isn't it?
Yep.
Pretty much. If you go and edit any of these objects, so if we were to edit sort of flight 44... one of your problems you have in a classic sort of caching scenario is this page knows nothing about flight 44. It's just cached an HTML fragment in memory, and it's rendering this page out. So if we change this to flight 50, for example, it's still going to keep rendering out flight 44, flight 44, flight 44 the whole time, because it doesn't really understand the concept of what's going on. So maybe we should change.
And you would have to wait for the cache to time out.
Yeah, so let's change that to flight 50 in the back end. The way in which we restore the cache against any particular view is if you call skin view object ID, the fragment is nominated against the object broker object ID. And as soon as you perform an update on that object ID, it flushes the whole thing from memory, including all of the things associated with it, which would be fine if it were the page. The problem is it's not the page, it's the parent page which is calling that fragment. But behind the scenes, Far Cry actually records all of the ancestors that that particular cache has been involved in. So it knows its parent cache, which knows the parent cache, which knows the parent cache, and it will automatically flush all the way up to the final kind of root cache that's being generated and then rebuild the page. The beauty of that is that the footers, the headers and footers, for example, don't participate in that cache at all. That ancestry has nothing to do with it. And so they just get rendered straight away, and it's only those things that could potentially have something embedded inside it automatically get flushed.
So now we're looking at the display body of a flight. So here we are looking at a flight, and I've set it to cache, and we can see here the web skin called display body. It's been cached. We can't see the display label of each of these passages because it's held up within the cache. So we haven't had to call all these things. However, if I change one of these passages, Matthew J, so just so we can see, display pipe, display body, nothing, nothing, nothing. We then go in and change Robin.
Middle name?
Robin's
Harry.
Hilliard. And so now, when we refresh that, you can see that it knows the context in which that's done, and so it's had to call the teasers again because it's had to refresh this display body cache. So now it's taken the 26 milliseconds, but however, now it's got it again, and now we're back to the cached output again. And so that becomes quite powerful when you've got the whole body, which rendering a header, which might take, you know, doing a whole bunch of things, and footers and the whole page. We could then go and on the display page standard, the entire page, which is located as an abstract, we'll whack our cache in there. So now the first time we call it, calls everything, puts it into its cache, and the second time, all it's got to grab is the display page standard, and everything else has been cached within that.
Yep. It's pretty cool. That's where I'm hoping to get applause tomorrow in my big presentation to all the mugs at...
And you get your 6 milliseconds loading time, where it's completely cached, but as soon as you change anything on that page, someone's name, it'll flush the cache. So it's totally dynamic, hardcore cache. And the trusted cache will turn it.
It's just a memory. It's just swapping out a memory straight away. Bang, bang.
Yep.
Done.
And on the bit, I mean, this is a dumbed down little site, but
if you look at something like this site.
Yep.
So salvage sale in the US, which I think is a fabulous cold fusion case study style site. These guys had a legacy system that is all cold fusion running an auctioneering site. They're basically the eBay of junk. Anything over $2,500 pretty much, from smashed up tractors to, 50 garbage trucks, pallets of toilet paper, these guys sell it. It becomes critical, this kind of cash flushing, when you start building applications in the front end rather than just content management, which is sitting there for a day and somebody has a new news article that's published or they've changed a news article. When you're actually looking at live real-time bidding or changes that need to be reflected almost instantaneously on the site, it becomes a kind of a critical aspect of everything that you're doing within the view. Another thing that we think was really cool, I think, was that these guys introduced the Ajax view for? So one of the things you have in caching regimes that are very difficult is that as soon as you have something that's personalized to the individual profile, you have all kinds of nightmares trying to cache that, because you could produce caches for every single session. They'd have their own unique set of pages for each session, which can be a nightmare. If you've got a lot of users on the site, it becomes really difficult. What you really find, though, is that most people just have a single little area like the login box or their little quick links area or something that is unique to that user, and everything else can be cached in the same way. So we have the option of adding bAjax equals true to the skin view, and it will automatically Ajax in the view separately from the rest of the page. So you can have, I think UNSWTV is a good one actually, because that one runs the login pods. We all do as Ajaxes now. So you log in, the page basically is re-rendered, and your session comes just from an Ajax call rather than trying to disrupt the entire cache of the page and rebuild the entire page. So for some of the clients that we have that are running, you know, enormous kind of numbers of content items, and also they're being heavy hit in terms of traffic, like people like Salvage Sale, Mayo and the like, these kinds of caching are just super easy to implement and super powerful when all is said and done.
Yep.
No question. Any questions about caching? Tell us, ask us. I want to talk about this tomorrow, so anything that doesn't make sense, let us know, because I want to make sure we address it properly.
So do you let people add names to caches. So like if you pass parameters, if you pass your ST params into a web skin.
Jeez, he's good, isn't he? Son?
Very good.
then other params built into the name of the cache so that you have unique cache versions of skins.
Exactly.
So it does a hash of the STPAM structure?
It does a hash of a number of things. Yep. So if you swap over to...
Sorry, swap to your screen, yep. So it's a good point.
So there's a couple of things. We can say cache by role.
Because you often have this nightmare where people are... They're secured in the members group or they're an admin or something, and you now want to build... You still want caching to be in place, but you want to build a whole heap of interfaces or additional menus or items that are on the page that are only reflecting that specific role, then you can cache by role. And it just makes basically a nice cut sort of slice of just a set of caches for that role or a set of caches for that set of parameters.
Yeah, that's the one bit.
Yep.
The architects and the people
like
that.
Yep.
So you could either call different web skins to do that and then cache each one separately, or you could handle that functionality within the web skin and just say if it's switched by role, cache by role, so whoever's looking at it, depending on which roles, they'll get that separate version. So that's a simple cache by role. However, if you pass in your STPARAMs, like you say, that will always cache it by that. A hash of all those params, so that's just done automatically. You don't have to say that.
Yeah, the problem, you know, like I had the problem that you can't guarantee the structures come back up, you know, in any particular order.
So we actually do our looping and sorting. Exactly.
Yeah.
So we do that. However, you might also have something in here that is, say, pagination, where you're putting page one, page two, and that will affect what the output says. And so you can cache by URL. However, that then leads you into maybe some denial of service where they'll just ping your site with 1, 2, 3, 4, 10 million and you've got a separate cache in your max up server. So what you can actually do is cache by vars and provide a list of url.page, url.cat, and just those variables that if they change, it'll have a different cache for each of those variables. Yep, very good.
Now, say also the other question is, you see you've got your select there. So because you're not going through the API,
my select,
like the 10 lines, 10 to
13. Oh, yes, 13, yeah.
So this view can't necessarily... I mean, I suppose it's the call to the skin.
It knows say, because of the skin.
Yeah, but if you weren't using a skin and you did something manual up there, is there a way that you could manually tell your caching infrastructure that these particular object IDs were involved in the cache?
Yep. So if you do something like that, and that's why we kind of, first of all, we stress, just use web skins. Because even though they're separate calls, it just allows the caching strategy just to work. It gives you all the hooks. However, sometimes it's not possible. You don't want to do it that way. There are FAPI functions, the Far Cry API functions, that say on a save event, you say just go and flush anything to do with this object. Or there might be links. A good example is, say, the latest news rule on the front of the page. So that will loop over the latest 5 news items. But if I add a new news item, it doesn't, and that's been cached, that rule news item's been cached, it doesn't know that there's a new news item. There's nothing in it to tell it that. So there might be a hook on the end of the after save news that says any time you save a news item, flush any rule news rules.
And all the associated caches of them, yeah.
And so you can flush them like that.
Okay, so calling individual views on the URL. We've got some of these nightmare names like display page standard. So you could call a URL, you could say, you know, type equals DM news view equals display page standard, and it becomes a bit of a nightmare. You could also say, all right, well, we've got these aliases in place, so you could say just slash DM news, get rid of the type, slash the name of the thing, but it's still DM news display page standard, and they're as ugly as sin, these kind of URLs. So you can actually apply an alias for the friendly URL call to any view, and you can have a decorator which is at FU alias and nominate exactly how you would like that specific view to be nominated on the URL. Also the component itself, FU alias, you can say however you'd like that to be. So if your naming structure for flights is something like FAR flight system, blah blah blah, whatever it happens to be for your component, you can distill that down to just I want on the URL to execute and call that by just slash flight. So now you can have slash flight slash schedule, and schedule might actually be display page standard or anything of that nature. So that's Matt calling.
It's just flight. I've got debugging and all sorts of.
Yep. Okay. Maybe we look at Vancouver.
Yep.
Show that. Yeah.
What is it?
Vancouver 2010 Olympics. Let's hope they haven't broken it today. .com.au. Okay, so this is actually quite an immensely complicated site, which gets more complicated as the Olympics approaches and we have all the results feeds start coming live and coming in. At the moment, it's really, I guess, it revolves around three primary content types, which are the athlete profile, the sports, and also news and events, which might be occurring in relationship to these people. If we drill down to, say, just go down to the homepage a little bit and select something from the schedule, what's coming up in the biathlon or something like that, on the left-hand side, or any of those items, shouldn't matter. Okay, look at this biathlon render event. Okay, so we almost got there. I don't know, they decided to throw in something called render event, which is not the greatest thing in an object ID. What have we got that might be a little bit less intimidating than that? So here we've got a URL which is calling sport. Biathlon is the name of the sport. Sports news is the name of the view that we want on that particular sport. It's a very clean, friendly URL. In fact, I think that's a partial friendly and an attribute, is it? Because biathlon is that. That's going to be.
No, sport news is the view.
Yeah.
Biathlon is the object ID.
Yep.
Sport is the type.
So it's relatively complicated. I think one of the things that we had to do in this is really test very heavily. I think one of the nice things, just probably we should just show MX Unit test integration. So there's a plugin for Far Cry called MX Unit Test. It's a popular unit testing framework that's in the ColdFusion community. We have a plugin mainly because it just makes it easier just to run directly inside Far Cry, but plus we have a whole series of hooks that give you access to certain things in the framework that you might want to test. And one of the things we've had to do a lot with 5.2 and the release of all of these kind of ultra-friendly URLs is the ability to test all the different variations of how these URLs can be generated. So this is a really... Blair's done a great job here with like an AJAX, series of AJAX calls going out, calling each of these individual tests that come back passed or failed as they run through. You can see the progress bar running at the top. There'll probably be a couple of fails in there, are there? Maybe he's done some patching.
But it means literally that as we're doing, so he's on here, that it doesn't work. If you, that's just because he's got his test wrong.
Yep.
He's expecting it to be in that order, and it was in that order. It means as we make, obviously, the changes to the friendly URL.
So we're looking at all these different variations in that you can have a friendly URL, which, as I said, is a string, any old string you want. You know, Jeff's mad URL on the string, blah, blah, blah. And it will map specifically to an object ID and view that you determine. And that's pretty much handled by the kind of content management side of things. If you're working in the content management area, you can literally just generate those friendly URLs. You don't have to think about it as a developer. They just automatically get generated and stored behind the scenes. But if you're actually constructing things on the URL like this, here's the view with an alias, with a body alias, with a parameter, you can even add the whole query string back onto the URL as a set of variable value pairs delimited by slashes. So if you want to have the classic kind of, you know, news for a certain month, you can literally say slash news, it'll go to the default type skin for news, but I want to put a parameter on the end for month, and it'll automatically start filtering by month if that's the code that you've got inside that particular view. And I guess, I don't know, it's hard to express how painful friendly URLs has been over the years. It's difficult to get a really clean URL that renders into a framework with heaps of parameters going all over the place. And I think we've really cracked it. And the 5.2 release is just a beautiful way of rendering URLs. And the variations and different options that you have for rendering those URLs are, you know, enough to satisfy even the most kind of anal developer, I think, in terms of how you want to represent the URL. You do, for friendly URLs, need to have a rewrite of some kind. Funnily enough, I found out from Microsoft at WebDU this year that IIS has its own rewrite engine now. I said to them, you know, you lost us at IIS bloody version, don't know what it was, when it just wouldn't do anything. And we pretty much do all of our deployments on Apache, whether it's Windows or Unix that we're deploying to. In those environments, you do need to do IIS. If you're running 2008, it has a pretty good rewrite engine, which is almost equivalent to mod rewrite, I'd say. But no one I'd ever talked to has ever heard of it, which is, I guess, a great battle for Microsoft to have to fight in terms of how they get that perception changed. In early... Sorry?
I think it's a good idea that nobody knows about
it. It's true. In earlier versions, there are ISAPI filters that you can get and implement, which will do the rewrites for you on IIS. Some are free. The free ones are probably less good. And the ones that cost money that are equivalent to mod rewrite cost around about $50 to $100. So there's not really a lot in it. But this is literally the rewrite that you need. It's a beautiful irregular expression, which you wouldn't want to wish that upon your worst enemy to try and work those out, but essentially we just exclude certain folders like Flash Services, Flexer Gateway, the Webtop, Far Cry, these sorts of things that might cause the friendly URL engine to trigger when it shouldn't, and then everything else we wrap up as a parameter which we pass to the friendly URL subsystem, which digests and interprets the URL before it gets passed into the controller.
And if you don't have the rewrite, the system will know about it, so when it builds its links, it won't use the friendly URL system. It'll just use...
So that's a...
When I've built stuff like this in the past, I've simply captured the state variables that you'd normally pass across in parameters in session.
Yep.
I'm wondering, is that a problem for anybody else? Because I've never known it to be... It's never been an issue for me to capture those things as I learn about them.
Yep.
Keep them in session, and then I don't ever need to worry about those parameters anymore. So, is there an issue that I'm not?
Yeah, the problem here is that you don't know in advance. Like, for example, you could go from a Google search and link straight to the Luge news page on Vancouver, and there are like eight URL parameters essentially that sit within that URL that would need to be translated and passed to the controller just to have that come through. If you had, and in the old days you would have had something like index.cfm, ?, object ID equals some horrendous UUID, then a couple of view parameters, something else. Google looks at it and goes, I've got a clue what that is, I'll try and digest the page. But if the URL's got biathlon, winter Olympic sport, blah, 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 schedule, news, any keywords you can imagine, it just starts to boost the ratings way up. Plus, it now means that, to a certain degree, if you're clever about how you prep those URLs, you can have users clip the URL. They can actually just take the end of the URL, like they think they're looking at a directory structure, and the controller keeps responding. It just sends less and less parameters to the framework to actually try and work out what you get.
That's exactly how I'm used to.
And you keep defaulting.
If you don't have your state information, you really want to start at the top of the primary list, so drill down, and then you start capturing the state information.
Yep. Sessions that can be great, that can be very dangerous. I mean, for example, in some sites, they're so heavily trafficked, we can't even get ColdFusion to invoke a session. If it invokes a session, it'll crash the server. I mean, it's almost that bad. You're getting so many sessions generated constantly that you're building this huge kind of state in memory just managing those sessions, even if they expire after 20 minutes.
The other way I can understand is use the session key as an index into a table where you have to run.
That's like your client's got...
Yeah, like clients go.
Externalised into the data store. And it also gives you the ability to manage all this stuff in a clustered environment because everybody's going to the database. All the cluster machines are going to the database to capture or recover that information.
Well, you don't have failover. Like in a really big site, you don't have failover. Between, you know, because you have to have sticky sessions because they arrive on one machine and all the session information is in the memory.
Or if it's in the data store, which is the reason I've used that. The request can go to any machine in the cluster and it's immediately got the state of wherever they were at on whatever machine.
The client scope's good. It's much maligned because of the old, because it used to default to being cookies. registry, which is awful.
Yeah.
Well, what you've described is kind of horrible. There are performance implications in using it, and you can't easily work with complex data types. It works well for lists and strings, and but trying to actually using arrays of CFCs, you know, I think that doesn't work very well. Mm-hmm. Although in ColdFusion 9 you can now normalize in and out again, still, it's, if you're working with simple data, it works very well.
Yeah.
And then
typically the data I work with, so I hate instantiating shitloads of crap in memory. I store primary keys and I use very complex queries. You go lift up all the stuff. You know, you really use a block of data
Yeah, there's a nasty method, I think. This is a bone of contention internally with us as to whether or not we start providing kind of gateway methods to pulling multiple objects from the system. You could say get all objects or something. Yeah, that you really want a much more complex query. So, for example, if you were versioning something, you might want to say get all the objects that meet this criteria that are approved and that this particular user has access to see and so on. And typically whenever we start to build these gateway functions, they're normally quite unique to the component. You don't even have to write them once for that particular content type, but it's writing a function which allows you all the flexibility and generic kind of wonderment of passing in attributes to do that call. Is it worth it? Where would we put it? And what would we do with it? And would we use it? And I think maybe it's just a prejudice internally that we don't use that, and so we don't really provide very good avenue for it. I used to like the old, does anyone know Reactor? In terms of the before the days of transfer and, you know, takeover of ORMs prior to CF9. It had a nice something like get by field or something like that, and you could actually say get by field and pass in a bunch of fields and basically a where clause you would pass into a function or come back with a thing. I think something simple like that might be useful, but at the moment we don't provide it.
That's sort of what Spec does with the... what I was trying to move towards with Spec was to have it more like just a library that's set to the... So Spec doesn't really have the core of Spec doesn't have a controller in it, really.
Yep.
But what you could do is you could go and build, like, say, a Fusebox application, and then you could think of at the places you wanted to insert content. There were four tags. One tag was to basically insert that sort of status bar thing that you've got. But the other tags were basically like containers, which are like a where clause. You just say, and in this way you can sort of have your normal model view controller, whatever the other framework is. You can just say, and at this point insert some content in exactly the same way, at this point insert an image or a flash movie or something like that.
The container acts a little bit like a controller just embedded in the page.
Yeah, it's actually like a bit of an inversion where you've made the CMS more like an API rather than a framework.
Yep.
So it's not controlling the whole request. You're using whatever the other framework is to do that.
Yeah.
Just at this point, you can go down the rabbit hole or whatever, and suddenly produce a whole load of content out of that spot.
It's interesting from a perspective of client requirements in terms of who likes this concept of container management, if you like, the sort of all the widgets on the page, like a portal site, you can choose the widgets you like and dress them up and do different things with them. And then those clients who just can't cope with it, as soon as they see it, they just fall apart. We have clients that sit on that spectrum. And so you can dress up Far Cry with containers everywhere. Like, actually, Vancouver is a good example. The homepage of Vancouver is just basically three containers with publishing rules and pods all over the place, because they constantly keep saying, oh, we want to move the video feature up to the top now because we've got a really good video. Now we've not got any good videos, we've got a really good something else, we want to move it down to the bottom. And they can just do it at will, however they like. Other people, they just can't cope with it. They do it so intermittently that to come back to the system and try and work out how they did it before, it's all too hard. The nice thing about Far Cry is literally, it is the tools are all there. You can introduce them if you want, remove them if you like. Type web skins, little mini ones embedded in the page, behave like containers and publishing rules without the attributes being passed into them, and you can easily convert. In fact, it's like two lines of code that kind of convert them into a publishing rule where you pass in ST params, and that's all the publishing rule is really doing, is passing in ST params into a view and changing its behavior in some way. I don't know, it's also a big challenge for us when we have a community distribution. We have, I see a lot of other simpler CMS solutions out there, for example, which people go, oh yeah, it's much better than Far Cry, or it does this, or it does that. What do we distribute? I mean, we could probably distribute Amura, for example, or one of these. I think another one I like the look of was who is it? Does it has all these portal things? You can drag things from one side to another, and it's this whole kind of magical interface, which is like publishing rules on steroids. Again, we could build something. You can drag and drop them. We've got the prototypes for dragging and dropping between containers. You can just drag and drop, and it's. I don't know, some of the stuff that's coming out now, not in the cold fusion community, but in the kind of software as a service community, of people who are building simple CMSs with all these really glossy interfaces, they're great up to a point. Typically, all of them have a very set structure for the templating. You can't really get outside of their templating structure, otherwise none of these kind of widgets work properly. And it's where do we pitch ourselves in terms of actually putting out a community distribution. For the last couple of years, we've been saying, well, here's a sample application that runs on top of the framework. Because from our perspective, we never use the plugin, really, for larger clients. Salvage Sale or Mayo or anything, they just wouldn't use that. It's just too simple. News and events and facts, and they're just not interested. They really need something that's tailored. And as you've seen today, I guess, that it's so easy to build your own content type and tailor it. And the next step, build a publishing rule, if you like, and allow someone to change it, that the time it takes to review a Drupal's plugin list to choose the one you want is kind of more time than it actually takes to build the thing outright and display it. And a lot of that's got to do with Cold Fusion, to be honest. I mean, if you're tasked with building something in PHP, I don't know, for Joomla or whatever, you've got that hurdle straight away. I mean, you heard earlier about the problems with LDAP that Melbourne Law School were having. We have an LDAP plugin. I mean, Christ, it's so easy to build an LDAP plugin. You just CF LDAP, we've got a config file, it passes in all the attributes, and away we go. We hook it up to our security framework, and it's done. It's magical. You don't even have to think about it. And we can just pump them out as hard as you like. As soon as Cold Fusion's got a tag in place that does the work, all we're doing is prefacing it with a series of attributes that we're kind of channeling in, and away we go. RPX now, I think, is going to be a great thing. This OpenID thing we're releasing. We don't have many clients we deal with at Exchange, unfortunately, because they all get wrapped up in bloody SharePoint the whole time. So it's now trying to bring them around to the fact that SharePoint really isn't as good as it was made out to be, and perhaps we could integrate with your SharePoint solution. I mean, we have lost some large clients to SharePoint, unfortunately, less because of local decisions, actually, more because of international ones where, you know, they're multinational conglomerates where Microsoft have done a worldwide deal on the license. We had one client was such a classic, the worldwide deal on a license for Exchange 2007 or something. And they had SharePoint hooking up to it. It was this kind of miracle intranet, and it was just the most beautiful thing on earth. And they were sold on it, and that's the way they went. Unfortunately, they were stuck on Exchange, I don't know, 2000 or something, way back in the dark past, and had no schedule internally to actually upgrade for 3 years. And so they were rolled back on like SharePoint 1, to be able to work with everything they had, and they just had them, it's just a mess, a total piece of garbage that didn't work at all, but sold on the vision for what they will get in 2010 or whatever when they actually make the rollout. And by then, you know, it's old news anyway. It's all no longer what they were sold. But tragically, that's what you're fighting against all the time. I guess that's just a general fight in the whole Cold Fusion world. We've moved away from even selling Cold Fusion as the platform. It's just the solution we're offering, and Cold Fusion is the best platform for the solution. And it may, you know, it's always swings and roundabouts. It may come back to you're now selling the platform hard. Adobe doesn't help us in selling the platform. He's sort of been trying to hit anybody out there from Adobe, but it's difficult because you're not.
Hey, there are people.
But it's you're not kind of out there with the same kind of level of exposure that other frameworks, well, not frameworks, but application environments are. And so it's hard to push that as the reason why you should be moving forward is Cold Fusion. The reason is we're developers, we have a solution. Cold Fusion just makes that solution one of the best on earth. And that's what we're selling is the solution. I mean, some of the things we do in Far Cry are purely and utterly because it's running on Cold Fusion. We've had this debate internally, should we be going to God's own language, which is Python apparently. This is, you know, the latest thing. Python's everything to all people. Because we do quite a bit of work in Python at the moment. And obviously Django is very similar to Far Cry, should be ported. But at the end of the day, it's still really tough to build web applications in a language that's not designed for the web. And Cold Fusion still makes that easy. I mean, I'm not... Are you a big CF Script fan? Not really. Yeah, neither of us are big CF Script fans. And obviously CF9, a big thing is, you know, you can script everything. It's bloody marvellous. You can script a lot. But, but you know, you come from a background that's... Yeah, we won't hold it against you, I guess. But it is interesting that those are feature enhancements that... I don't know, for us it doesn't make a great deal of difference, but obviously maybe it's helping battle against the greater kind of community out there that insist upon it being there. It's
not
never
just,
been.
Like, not just a recent convert from PHP. So.
Yeah. Well, I guess it does matter, like, especially when you're building the templates, the whole idea about having tags really, really helps. It makes the structure look very good because HTML is based in an XML language. And when you're trying to define logic, tags really, it makes the logic look very robust. So something you're doing like 500 lines looks like 1,000 lines, and like, what is it doing? Why is it so big? And why do I have to scroll up and down?
Yep.
When you have a proper HTML structure.
Yeah, I was going to say, as soon as you've got a conditional logic, yeah, I agree. If you've got a large set of conditional statements, then that CFF is a bit of a disaster. Yeah. But yeah, these are all great enhancements as we move forward. So yeah, like it. So anyway,
I do believe if you have tags, have tags. If you have code, have code. If you try to mix two in, and you just create a big mess.
Well, I think one of our really big pushes for Far Cry has been we want it to be the way people like to program Cold Fusion. And I don't think it's CFScript. I think it's tags. Don't get me wrong, everything's component orientated for us. It's, you know, we're making method calls and the model view controller patterns or MTV or whatever you want to call that particular area behind the scenes. But when you're interacting with it on a daily basis as a Cold Fusion developer and you're writing Cold Fusion tags, we want that to be as seamless as possible for people. And so that's why some of our efforts, I don't know, maybe it's taken us down a slightly different path, certainly a slightly different path to other frameworks out there, which are very much porting ideas from other languages into Cold Fusion.
Yeah, that's horrible. I mean, I've rambled against that, you know, for a long time, because the whole point, I mean, even the things with, like, the scripting, that's one of my beefs about MX unit and some of the other unit testing things, is they just took the X unit thing and brought it over.
Yeah.
And in Cold Fusion we have this, you know, we can have eval. And we can just write any expression that we like and assert whether or not it's true or false.
Why did we go MX unit and not go rocket boot unit, rocket unit? What was the decision behind that?
Probably for the conspiracy theory.
That's it. I think it was Blair.
There's the first thing is use the language for it is. That's why I hate the whole Cold Fusion as XML. Sort of thing.
Oh, I don't know. I have a fetish for closing tags. I can't help myself. CF set close tag.
But imagine what it would look like. It's never going to be.
Exactly. I don't know what it is. I can't help it. CF set close tag, and I'll be looking at somebody else's code, and I'm there close. I'm sure there's somebody going exactly the opposite in the other side of the company.
I'm complaining that the tag I've done for. Typing humans type.
Oh, CF capture.
Yeah, the recapture tag that I wrote. He was saying, you should put some logic in there to make sure that the tag only executes and start when it's starting. And I just said, no, I just look at this education campaign.
Yeah, in
cold
fusion. That's right.
Execute the closing tag logic.
Yeah. So anyway. All right, cool. So we thought we'd...
Sorry,
Karen. Fine, wait, yeah.
How do you see, what do you see Far Cry evolving to in the Cold Fusion powered rich into application world?
It could certainly be the kind of content repository which delivers that content to people. I guess, ultimately, a lot of the stuff that we do renders out to HTML. And so if you're replacing all the admin screens as Flex and all of the output as Flex, then it takes away a lot of the nice things in the framework which make it really great. But having said that, there's all of the stuff that we do behind the scenes anyway for capturing the data, storing the data, modeling the data, which I think is quite different it's very different to other frameworks. Generally, in terms of our approach, we don't look at the database and then express a set of components. We look at a set of components and then we build a schema. And so I think that's also something that turns a lot of people off. They're used to building their tables and they're used to having the control over exactly how the schema is going to work, and then they'll use something to generate the CRUD components for that set of tables.
One thought on that is that most opportunities you get starting off with an existing data store.
Yep.
So working back from the data model is probably more normal than a greenfield site where you define the data and have generate everything.
Yeah. So in those situations, we actually build a component model in content types, which will ultimately pull in the third party tables for that. And so even if that content type doesn't really have anything associated with it beyond a reference to where it's going to get the data in the first place, it gives you a hook that opens up the rest of the framework to allow you to do that. And the framework includes things like nested tree modeling, the security, the category engine, keywording, all the sort of implicit relationships that we can get through keywording, category engines and so on, plus all the explicit relationships we can get through the different object references between the content types that we have in the model that we run and so on. But yeah, in terms of moving towards a flex environment...
We also looked at, WebSkins can output whatever they want.
Yeah, they can output anything.
Can output the MXML.
Yeah, so I guess what I was kind of doing is, have you thought about taking Firefly, in the future generation of Firefly, divorcing Firefly, the storage content rules, publishing everything else from Firefly, the HTML generator, and having them actually two separate tiers, one sits on top of the other, but then make it usable in a pure services-based environment so that it is useful and usable in a flex network?
It was not something we've really discussed a great deal. I think one of the things we did look at a while ago was actually generating MXML, which we could then include at runtime into an application. So, for example, we have a grid in HTML, and we have the concept of views or cell renderers, which will change the individual cells of the grid. We wanted to do the same thing in Flex, for example. So we'd have a Flex app, and everything that we're doing in the sort of view side will generate that markup, which can then be compiled to the Flex app. The problem is, it's that compilation step and working out how we...
Yeah. Move from a script... Round-trip-driven world to
you'd have to have a publishing step.
Yep. Making the automatic bridge is very, very important.
Well, one of the things that we have that's quite useful, it may not be the right place for Flex, is the form tools engine, where you can actually define from the content type or the object model that we've got in place the metadata for each property, and that automatically renders out all of the individual form fields, field sets, wizards, and so on. What we'd like to be able to do, I guess now what we've done is completely ripped out what we had before, which was the XTJS. We've moved to jQuery UI, and that's being implemented. It'd be nice to be able to implement other types of rich internet application environment at that level. Whether that's Flex, I don't know.
We actually wrote a content management service for a client early this year. It was a Flex client. But what we actually build is we build a series of, In fact, I think the last time, I remember being in a room about 10 years ago with Charles Teddy and us, and you heckling at the back and you teaching Spectrum.
Could have been.
I had heckled Spectrum from first prototype till final decimal.
Yeah. All right. But enough to say that idea. So, and the idea was that you actually did have your renderers were actually different parts. We actually had a fragment of a normal Flex component as the renderer for the content type, and you had this little container that you put it into, and we had your renderer, you had this special container that you would nest it in, the actual renderer would be the child of this container. You also had this one thing we put up in our services in XML, which was our connector to connect to this content management service. And then the idea was that you could actually be in your Flex app and enable the flag, and all the containers would suddenly enable to have all the little highlights around them. And what you do is you go and click on the highlights to say edit the container rules, and it actually open a, in this case, it actually opened an AJAX HTML window where they did the object picker and selected all the things that were going to go into it, and then it actually just updated the container basically.
Yeah.
So there is a sort of world there which they work quite nicely.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are struggling with how to bridge that world, and a lot of people are discovering that for brand new developments, yes, you can build really cool rich internet applications, but in the real world, you end up with hybrids and things that are partial do, I've got to focus for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are struggling with how to build that back end so that it is usable both in the traditional work world and the rich internet application world.
You're trying to build an API that would just expect service calls?
The problem is you need to service call a Flex app.
Commands, go every single kind of
the FlexApp calls, and do a query our service calls too.
It's just XML. It's coming there. But yeah, I.
You just want to be able to treat the content like Thingweaver or like some other sort of little plugin or external sort of image that we're talking to CM7 or something that's going off and doing some stuff and getting us some images. You said it could be going off and getting us some content. And then we have a much smaller, simple model view controller app, which just happens to have all the big chunks of content coming down from a content service with our little library of display objects.
I've been interested in the whole generation software stuff that you know people are getting into. Interested because Far Cry, in many instances, is kind of like a runtime version of that. We define almost like a software domain language for how content will work, or when you talk about content, a record, some kind of thing in the model. And then from that, we generate all of the edit handlers and administrative interfaces, and then we can generate all of the individual views. The nice thing about the way the plugin architecture works in Far Cry is everything can have a view by default, which you can then, if you choose to, just tweak and override so it looks the way you want it to look. And so in many instances, we have situations where we have apps that roll out that are effectively just a library of plugins set with defaults, with tweaks and configuration in the project, and you have an instant app and a new skin comes on top and it looks different. The problem is it's runtime, whereas other people are out there experimenting with stuff where they get that sort of thing in place, they hit a button and they generate all of these files, which then sits as a kind of static app, which you can't really change without regenerating all the files. I guess you could go down that path for Flex building would be interesting, but I don't know. It's tough, isn't it? I think it's tough.
Yeah, I'm not sure there is a lot of synergy there. I'm just trying to find...
Yeah.
I'm trying to come up with recommendations in general. We've been asked this a lot. And I don't think there is a logical transition point yet. We'll be struggling with ourselves trying to find people to do that.
Can Far Cry be written, used in such a way that it's a headless application?
You can. We, for example, write APIs in Far Cry's views. So you might have a kind of REST-like API where you would call slash content type slash some kind of view, which is a method call which returns XML or JSON or something of that nature, which other things can interact with. UNSWTV, for example, they have third-party apps like Blackboard, which want to suck in what media items they have for distribution in their learning management systems, and they just make a simple URL call which returns... you know, the data straight out in whatever format's appropriate. I think we do JSON and XML as sort of a specialised XML format for them. But it could be anything. You'd have to set up a facade object in the WebRoot so that you could actually make access to that. We don't allow access generally to any of the components, or they don't respond in a way that's meaningful deliberately, so that we don't have, you know, people trying to punch their way through into the system. But setting up a facade would be easy. We've done it several times.
So you'd do something like a server remote?
Yeah, you'd have a CFC with a bunch of remote methods which are expecting certain parameters to come through, and then they internally work through the machinery of the framework to pull the data and give it back. Yeah. Good. Well, let's have a break. We've got a quick sort of case study of UNSWTV in Vancouver, which we've kind of looked at quite a bit, just to sort of round things up, to talk about, you know, how you'd approach building a really big application in Far Cry. And then I guess we can all march off for drinks and end the day. But a cup of coffee, I think it's time. It's 3:30. 15-minute break.